Chapter 3. Spiritual, but not anxious. The idea that religious folks are anxious is not breaking news. Stressing out and worrying about morality, purity, and eternity is what we expect of religious people. Religious anxiety causes people to worry that an idiotic pastor descending an imaginary flight of stairs behind the altar disrespects the sanctity of the holy space and displeases the divine. It assumes that an unregulated dialogue with unregulated addicts will inevitably come off the rails and lead to eternal doom. Religious anxiety tells us that only certain types of people living certain kinds of lives are okay. If only it stopped there. Sadly, religious anxiety is far too often a home for our hatred and the dread that drives dehumanization. It lies at the root of each exclusionary boundary we develop and every dogmatic superstition to which we surrender. It lurks in the mind of every devout adherent or worshiper who believes their God or their faith is threatened or under attack. Religious wars, genocides, and enslavements, our very worst behavior, are all driven and fueled by anxiety. For many of us, anxiety is baked into our religious beliefs and practices, and it has been for millennia. It's embedded in our theology and ideology. Sometimes, we are the point of origin. Other times, religious anxiety is smuggled into our lives through seemingly benign channels and trusted relationships. There is a reason that the phrase spiritual but not religious has entered our lexicon. More and more people are finding it difficult to reconcile their spiritual experience or worldview with the religious systems in which they have been raised or to which they have been exposed. While anxiety may not be the expressed reason people push away from the feast table of religion, it is influencing us nonetheless. When we are drawn to mysticism, meaning, and wonder, but burdened by religious baggage, we are longing to be spiritual but not anxious. The simple and yet historically confounding thesis of this book is that it should not be this way. Religion should be the counter to anxiety, not its cause. It should be the cure, the alternative, or the antithesis to anxiety. If our religious beliefs and spiritual practices foster anxiety in us or in others, then we are doing it wrong. Regardless of our particular tradition or background, if our faith and praxis do anything other than ground us to a connected and compassionate reality, then we have lost our way. Chapter 4. Good and Terrible. As prevalent and persistent as anxiety may be, it can nevertheless feel somewhat elusive. Let's start with this. Fear and anxiety are not the same thing. Many of us use these words interchangeably, but they are not interchangeable at all. Our confusion is understandable. Both fear and anxiety are emotional responses. The manifestations of fear and anxiety in our lives can often overlap and mimic one another. In many ways, fear and anxiety can feel the same to us. They both tend to lead to some of our worst behavior. We are neither at our best nor thinking clearly when we are afraid or anxious. Yet, despite their perceived common ground, fear and anxiety are different. And the distinction is important. Fear is good. We may not feel that in the midst of our experience of fear, but it is nonetheless a necessary and protective emotional response. Fear is an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation of awareness or danger. It works on our behalf, marshaling our mental and physical resources in the face of danger. Fear activates our sympathetic nervous system, the network of nerves that engages our fight or flight response. As part of our autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system can, without any conscious effort on our part, regulate a vast assortment of the body's physiological divisions, from respiration, immune function, and stress chemicals to blood pressure and heart rate. The activation of our sympathetic nervous system prepares and equips us to respond to danger. It puts us on alert and focuses us for survival. As neuroscience and psychology professor Matthew Walker notes, however, the sympathetic nervous system is highly adaptive under conditions of credible threat for short periods of time lasting minutes to hours. Simply put, fear activates our sympathetic nervous system to get us out of danger quickly. As Walker writes, survival is the goal, and these responses promote immediate action to accomplish just that, but leave that system stuck in the on position for long durations of time, and sympathetic activation becomes deeply maladaptive. In fact, it is a killer. Leaving our sympathetic nervous system stuck in the on position is an apt description of anxiety. And unlike fear, it's not good. Anxiety is terrible. We experience anxiety as an abnormal or overwhelming sense of apprehension, uneasiness, or nervousness, usually over an impending or anticipated ill. Like fear, it is an emotional response, but as the American Psychological Association describes, anxiety is not typically caused by an external trigger or stressor. Instead, anxiety is defined by persistent, excessive worries that don't go away even in the absence of a stressor. In a sense, fear describes an acute emotional response, while anxiety describes something more chronic. Anxiety persists. Unlike fear, it does not fade or subside when the perceived threat or moment of danger has passed. Anxiety continues even without an actual crisis. Fear is an almost automatic or instinctual response to perceived danger. Anxiety, on the other hand, is developed. It is an attempt to avoid, control, or manipulate the emotions that so disturbed us in the first place. Our experience of fear and anxiety may feel similar, but as the National Alliance on Mental Illness indicates, anxiety is a reaction to our emotions versus danger in the environment. Anxiety is a stop reaction to the impulses that fear and other core emotions create inside the body. For example, fear mobilizes energy for movement, and anxiety pushes it back down. Anxiety results from avoiding core emotions and needs. More specifically, anxiety results from the physical effort to push down emotions. If we know we are not in physical danger in a moment, yet we are experiencing something akin to fear, we can assume we are experiencing anxiety. Imagine seeing a child you love playing too close to the street. Without any conscious thought or intentionality, you are now afraid. Your sympathetic nervous system automatically kicks on, better enabling you to take action to protect the child from traffic. You run to the child, scoop her up, and get her away from the street. Once the child is away from danger, however, the crisis is over. Your adrenaline subsides, your breathing slows, your sympathetic nervous system calms back down. The moment has passed, and so has your fear. Later that day, you remember the intensity of the moment. You don't want to think about it, but you begin to consider what might have happened had you not seen the child or been able to get to her in time. Reliving and rewriting the event, you begin to have an emotional response. Only this time, it's not fear. The child is not actually presently in danger. What is happening now is only happening inside of you. The external trigger that incited your fear no longer exists, and yet, you are anxious. Such is the case with anxiety. An actual threat or crisis is not required. In his book, The Anxiety Reset, Dr. Gregory Jantz writes, "When you are paralyzed by anxiety, what you actually fear is the feeling of being afraid." Anxiety is not limited by reality. In fact, anxiety dwells in the creation and embrace of alternative realities that may not have ever happened in the past, nor ever happen in the future. Our expressions of and experience with religious anxiety are no different. Religious anxiety is not limited by reality. It, too, dwells in the creation and embrace of alternative realities which may not have ever happened in the past, nor ever happen in the future. Religious anxiety, like all anxiety, tells us we are not okay. Chapter 5. Dysfunction Junction, What's Your Function? From 1973 to 1985, the ABC television network earwormed education into the minds of millions of children on Saturday mornings with a series of 3-minute musical cartoons known as Schoolhouse Rock. I have a degree in English, and I am married to an English teacher, but believe me when I tell you that I know what a conjunction is, not because of school or my wife, but because of Conjunction Junction, an episode of Schoolhouse Rock. If you haven't seen it, you should stop what you're doing, get yourself to YouTube, and watch it. It will take 3 minutes, and you will end up smarter than you are right now. If not, then let me tell you, without any cool music or animation, that a conjunction is a part of speech that connects words, phrases, or clauses. Religion is a conjunction of sorts. At least, it should perform a similar function, only instead of connecting parts of speech, it should connect us. The ancient Latin word religare, which is arguably the root of our modern word religion, means to rebind or reconnect. Did you catch that? The prefix re means again, and ligare means to bind or connect. Religion means to connect again, in much the same way that our ligaments connect our bones and bind together our joints, religion should reconnect us. The next logical question is, reconnect us to what? If religion is like a conjunction, what is its function? The truth is, asking what is the function of religion is likely to generate at least as many possible answers as there are religions. Each of us carries a unique perspective, varied and dynamic experiences, thoughts, and emotions that color and shade how we see religion and what we expect of it. Our embrace of religion is also not static or uniform throughout our lives. The way in which we hold and interact with religion changes. We tend to look to it for different things in different seasons. How we answer questions regarding its role or function may not even be the same from one day to the next. What is consistent, however, is that no matter what we may hold the function of religion to be, we can all agree it should not be to reconnect or reattach us to anxiety. To begin, we are scarcely in need of an anxiety reattachment. It's not something with which most of us are in the habit of losing contact. We maintain the attachment all on our own. Once more, were we to have the unimaginable experience of living without anxiety, our own or others, is that something to which we would want to be reconnected? The reality is we have no need of a system, religious or otherwise, to connect us to anxiety. If anything, anxiety is an accepted part of our lives. We're quite used to it, if not outright addicted. Psychiatrist and author Ellen Vora calls anxiety the verb, the vibe, the texture, the pH of our age. Our daily lives are awash in it. And why shouldn't they be? One need only turn on a television or scroll a social media feed for a few moments to realize there are plenty of reasons to be anxious every day. Consider how much the average person processes in a single day. Emails, phone calls, voicemails, text messages, social media posts, traffic reports, appointment alerts, news updates, advertisements, online entertainment, and shopping. And that's before you consider the demands of the workplace and actual conversation with friends and family. Beyond the sheer volume of information we must handle, much of what we see prods us to be afraid, vigilant, worried about what we're missing out on, or aware of things that could go wrong if we don't give them our full attention. It's positively toxic. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, 31.1% of adults in the United States suffer a diagnosable anxiety disorder at some point during their lives. The most common anxiety disorder we endure is generalized anxiety disorder, whereby we experience excessive, hard-to-control worry that may jump from topic to topic. The very act of hearing about anxiety may be making you anxious right now. Like me, you may be scrolling through your emotional Rolodex of anxious standbys. You know, the anxieties you can summon anytime. Connecting to anxiety is not a function we need religion to perform, if for no other reason than we perform that function by ourselves. By ourselves is the important and operative phrase in that last sentence, because that is what anxiety requires to thrive: detachment and isolation. That is not to say we don't spread or share our anxiety with others. As we will learn, we are fully adept at disseminating our anxiety. Still, the anxiety we experience is born of detachment and isolation. When we are truly connected to another, our anxiety no longer has an echo chamber. It no longer has an audience of one. The arguments it makes must now stand up to another perspective, worldview, and interpretation. Connection, the antidote to isolation, is the true function of religion. At least it should be. Religion should reconnect us to who we are. It should center us in our shared being, grounding us in relationship with each other and ultimate reality. The conjunction function of religion is to reconnect or reattach us to everyone and everything. Its function is not to foster or fester anxiety, but to serve as its terminus, the place where anxiety stops. We can be sure that if our religion creates, distills, or harbors anxiety in any way, it is disconnected and therefore dysfunctional. Chapter 6: When Religion Has a Fever. One of our friends has two children, Claire and Yates, who are 4 years apart, but their birthdays are close to one another. One year, when their birthdays were approaching, our friend called the local grocery store to order a custom birthday cake for the two children to share at an upcoming party. When the employee on the other end of the phone asked her how she wanted the message on top of the cake to read, she said Claire is 6 and Yates is 2, as in T-W-O. A week or so later, we happened to be on hand at the party when Claire and Yates' mother opened the box to reveal their cake, which read, "Claire is sick, S-I-C-K, and Yates is 2, T-O-O. So close, but clearly something was lost in the translation. It was not just the mishearing of words, but a complete lack of reflection on the nature of cakes. Did the employees involved in making such a cake not think it was strange for a mother to order a cake celebrating the illness of her children? Unfortunately, this analogy also seems to accurately describe the religious anxiety we need to confess and confront. Not only has the message on top of our cake been lost in translation, but like the employees in the grocery store, we seem too busy and distracted to notice. Religion should not birth or support anxiety any more than a cake should celebrate sickness. When we find or experience anxiety within our religion, it is evidence that something is off. In fact, anxiety arguably serves an evolutionary and spiritual purpose when we recognize it as a symptom of illness. In the same way that a fever communicates malady in our body, anxiety should draw our attention to emotional unhealth. A fever alerts us to the presence of a virus or possible infection. It lets us know that the body is defending itself and needing to move toward healing and restoration. Similarly, anxiety alerts us to repressed needs and unprocessed emotions, thoughts, and experiences. It, too, lets us know that we are not okay, that something in us requires attention. And just as we would not let someone with a fever operate heavy machinery, we should not be left to our own devices when we are under the influence of anxiety. We're not at our best. We're not thinking clearly. Our actions and words will most likely not make much sense. Once more, we can't fix it on our own. We require care and connection to heal. In the Anxiety Reset, Gregory Jantz points out that sustained anxiety prevents the growth of new brain cells and creates an anxiety-affected brain chemistry that can perpetually circle back to reinforce and sustain anxiety. In other words, we get stuck in a loop, a closed system. Chronic anxiety becomes a self-reinforcing prison, one that gradually erodes our ability to imagine anything else. Rather than recognizing it as a symptom that alerts us to unhealth and encourages the nurturing relationships necessary for restoration, we adjust and acclimate to anxiety. We accept it as just the way things are. Our religious systems and traditions are no different. Why should they be? They are constructs, the organized beliefs and practices of people, and as we have already established, people are anxious. Our anxiety-affected brain chemistry goes where we go, making religion susceptible to the fever. Just like us, religion can get stuck in a loop and become a self-reinforcing prison. In the same way that chronic anxiety prevents the growth of new brain cells, religious anxiety encloses us in self-affirming ideas and expressions that erode our ability to imagine beyond the system. We lose not only the capacity to notice that the message on the cake is wrong, but also our grasp of the cake's purpose. We don't bake cakes to celebrate sickness, and we don't practice religion to be grounded in anxiety. In truth, anxiety seems to have been in the water of religion from the very beginning. As soon as we were able to conceive of a source or unseen reality, we have been anxious about it. That's the thing about an unseen reality. It's hard to predict and impossible to control. Not that we haven't tried. We've gone to great lengths to appease the gods, to please the Creator, to make sure we are on the right side of the divine, and that the spirits are on our side. Even worse, we are all too willing to create and venerate religious experts who can tell us what to do. Kings and warlords, shamans and priestesses, gurus and pastors who communicate with the unseen reality and instruct us toward its control and manipulation. In closed religious systems, however, it is the anxious who are manipulated. At their core, our religious and spiritual traditions attempt to address the big questions. Who are we? Why are we here? What is the meaning of life? How is it all connected? When we mix in experiences of evil, suffering, and death, not to mention doctrinal stumbling blocks built around sin, punishment, or purification, there is more than enough material for repression and chronic anxiety. Though undoubtedly well-intentioned, our religions often enable us to become unwitting experts at repressing experiences, emotions, pain, and stress, usually in pursuit of maintaining the status quo and preserving the tradition or the institution. Repressing our fear is one thing. Doing it in the name of God takes it to a whole other level, one that is highly manipulable and extremely profitable. Empires have been built upon religious anxiety. Kingdoms and crusades have been well-populated and well-funded for thousands of years by the religiously anxious, yielding their agency toward blind compliance, thoughtless action, and transactional patronage. The ubiquity of religious anxiety around the globe and throughout our history is a symptom. It's a fever pointing to unhealth. It is highly communicable, to be sure, but it is also communicative. It's telling us that something is wrong.